Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is January 3rd, and we have Dr. Mark Faber and Ira Harris. Dr. Faber is the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. Website is gloomboomdoom.com, which highlights unusual investment opportunities. It's a great publication. I'm a subscriber myself and learn immensely from the insights. Dr. Faber is also the author of several books, well known for his contrarian investment approach. Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great. I thought we'd begin with the discussion, your view, Dr. Faber, your current insight into global macro on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, I've argued already for the last 3 months in my report that if you measured the statistics properly, we would be in recession. And, you know, there are many ways to define GDP and economic prosperity and so forth. But the fact is that for the first time in a very long time, actually, in probably about 40, 50 years, real incomes around the world are declining. They're not increasing. In other words, maybe your salary goes up by 5%, but if the inflation is up by 8%, then in real terms, your income is down 3%, which means that your standard of living diminishes by 3%. And if we look at the PMI indicators around the world, they're now at 46%. So in other words, in recessionary territory. So I think in general, the business also when I observe, when I go out and so forth, I observe how businesses are doing. The existing businesses are doing okay, but a lot of businesses are finished. They haven't reopened, do you understand? And there are new businesses that have opened up. But in general, when I also read about the mental state of the Generation Z, it occurs to me that they are not as well-to-do as their parents were when their parents were like 30 years old. You understand? And there are statistics published by the Federal Reserve. That's interesting that the Fed publishes these statistics, but keep on telling people how well the Fed has done. According to the Fed, the 35 years old today are less affluent. In other words, they have less assets than their parents had when they were 35 years old, and they earn less than the parents earned when they were 35 years old, all inflation adjusted. These are not my statistics. These are statistics by the Federal Reserve themselves. Mm-hmm. But of course, they keep on lying to the public and so forth. But this we have to get used to. The governments are agencies that lie to the people continuously.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, for initial
thumb? Yeah, I'm not as... I can't even argue... nor would I want to, but, you know, somebody, when they heard that I was going to be on with Dr. Faber, with you, Richard, they posed a question to me and to myself, but I would pose it back to Dr. Faber in this realm. is, are we embarking on a stagflationary period in the US because fiscal policy is working across purposes of monetary policy? And is this going to get us into that type of trap where we keep trapping ourselves because there's fiscal stimulus, the Fed's trying to slow things down, and yet there's more fiscal stimulus? And of course, the more things slow, especially with this administration, the more they will push for fiscal stimulus. And now, so do you see that, you know, playing out because of the cross purposes of what's going on?
Well, I think that if you think it through, the more fiscal stimulus there is, the more expansion of the government there is, the less growth there is, because growth comes from private initiatives, not from government programs. And I think the larger the government becomes within the economy, the less growth you will have. I mean, if we look at the period 1800 to 1900 in the US, when the government expenditures in all the European countries and in America was less than 9% of GDP, there was much stronger growth in those days. Now, someone will say, well, it was a period of injustices and so forth. I think we have today exactly the same injustices as we had then, maybe even more, and less economic growth and less opportunities. So I'd say, please, US government, spend more and more fiscal stimulus, because that will kill your economy in the long run. In the long run, it will be state-owned. That's the recipe for complete disaster. But the socialists, they love it. They want more government. All the young people say, well, the government has to do more for us. And there are people in the US, affluent people, they support the socialists. They give money to the socialists and so forth to expand their power. Because under socialism, under state ownership, some people become immensely rich, the way you become immensely rich by creating wars that are completely unnecessary.
Ira, you wanted to ask a...
So this is going to take us down a road, and I know Dr. Favre is really good with this. So that setting the table with that discussion, I have to ask, who's buying the long end of any sovereign debt market? Especially, I mean, on emerging markets, I can understand. I think they're acting far more responsible than the developed world. Who would be buying U.S. treasuries longer than two-year duration? Who would be buying European debt? Who's buying this?
Well, I have to say that I run a bond portfolio at all times because it's part of the diversification. But of course, it's not a bond portfolio with a maturity of 30 years. The average maturity is more like 4 or 5 years or even less. It varies a bit. And so within the allocation of bonds, I occasionally buy the long-term treasury ETF, TLT, which I trade. And at the present time, I have to say, in my opinion and with my view, that we are in a recession already, and that there will be a considerable demand destruction. In other words, as people have less money, through the decline in real incomes and through the collapse of asset prices. I just like to remind you that this bear market that began sometimes in 2021 for equities, not every stock peaked out the same day. But bonds, treasury bonds, they peaked out. In other words, the yields bottomed out in May, August 2020 already. And this bear market is unusual because if you look at 2007, 2009, and you look at 2000 to 2003, and you look at 1973, 74, and 81, 82, equities went down, but bonds rallied. This bear market, the beauty of it is that bonds have also collapsed. And the wealth destruction among the pension funds, most of which are run by incompetent people anyway, but the wealth destruction in the pension fund industry is huge. The unfunded liabilities have gone up dramatically. And so now with the yield on treasuries at a certain level and stocks still at very high prices, historically seen, I think that the Fed sometimes this year in 2023, they will realize that they tightened precisely at the wrong moment and that they have to ease again. And then in expectations of this, bonds should rally. And I would say that inflation is a funny thing. I mean, Ira, you raised the issue of the inflationary cycle. Yes, I believe that we are in an inflationary cycle that will probably exceed the highs of inflation we had in the 70s, and that bond yields in America, bond yields move in long cycles. We can call them contractive or whatever, but they're long cycles. So we had a peak in interest rates in 1980, and now in 81, actually, and now we had a low in 2020. And from here on, interest rates will go up in the world. There's no question about this. Now, how steep they'll go up, who knows? And in the 70s, they went up and then down again, up and down and so forth. So there were lots of trading opportunities in bonds. And I think we are now at a juncture where there's some trading opportunity, but not a dramatic opportunity because yields are so low.
And actually related to that on the equity side, do you see, you mentioned the 1970s, do you see a repeat now of the 1966 to 1982 timeframe for the equity markets? I mean, some observers have said we may go as low as 3,000 on the S&P 500 index, but do you think maybe we don't go that low, but in real terms, we do?
Yes, I think the 66 to 82 period is unusual because the market didn't move up for all the period. But we have to, or I have to remind people, because I lived through that period, that there were huge moves in markets, you know? And also in commodities, we had a big move between 69 and 73 in wheat, corn, soybeans, and then until 77 in coffee and cocoa, and then finally in gold and silver between 78 and 80. So it was not a uniform movement. And during the period, oil and oil-related and energy stocks performed very well. The drillers were star performers and so forth, and companies that never came off the ground, like Dome Petroleum, since you're in Canada. That was the big thing at the time. It was like Tesla. People didn't know how much they would go and earn, but it was a big thing.
Interesting.
So I think we are in a difficult period for asset markets. I think the investor should ask himself, not how much and how much should I earn and in what kind of instruments should I earn it, But what is the best way not to lose anything? That is the question, in my view. Because the S&P, the problem of the S&P, it's still overweighted by technology. Now, these technology stocks, some of them are oversold, and they can rebound and push up the S&P a bit. But they're not going to go back up to new highs anytime soon. It will, maybe they'll never make new highs, like Intel peaked out, and Cisco, they peaked out in the year 2000. They haven't made a new high. I can tell you, I can give you hundreds and thousands of stocks around the world. They peaked out at some point and never made new highs, never. But of course, the public is told, oh, stocks go up in the long run. Yeah, they maybe, but different stocks, not always the same.
Yeah, very interesting observations. Your thoughts, Aaron?
Well, you know, to pick up on that, so if we go from 1966 to 81, let's say, which is an interesting period, and part of it I was in university, and part of it I was on the trading floor learning out of. So I've seen it, and I've been thinking about this quite a bit lately, because when we enter this period now, when we trade the bond market, when we see the bond market, we are coming off a period where the central banks, led by, well, some people would say the Japanese, but I don't think the Japanese, led by the Fed, certainly by the ECB, we're starting at places where the valuations of the bond market are starting at ridiculous levels because their policies so badly corrupted the valuations so that they were basically meaningless except for those who had to partake in them. So now we're stuck in this position. We have an inverted yield curve in the US. We have an inverted curve in Germany for what that is worth. And we're looking at these. And, you know, I look at the long end of the bond market, and because we've been at preposterous levels and really nobody has a real good handle on what the valuations, and I use this word in its true philosophical sense, ought to be, we're groping in the dark in many, many ways. And we have fiscal stimulus, which is ramped up. We still have massive balance sheets. So I'm just tortured by trying to understand what the valuations would be, especially because the way that I see it is, will we live under the Volcker doctrine, or will we continue to thrive, for some people, under the Bernanke doctrine? Because that's, to me, how I'm dividing up the world. We had the, you know, just like we had the Brezhnev doctrine, we had the Gorbachev doctrine. We have doctrines. And will Powell succumb to the Bernanke doctrine? And I'm not talking about a pivot. It doesn't have to pivot. And that's, to me, it's a binary argument that need not take place. But will they get nervous, at, especially as Dr. Farber talked about, if they've squeezed too quick here? We don't know yet, where it's, you know, there's a lot of conjecture, then what will be their response? If they stop any type of quantitative tightening, what happens to the yield curve? There are so many things in play here because the central banks have so badly corrupted the markets, and they've not let the markets do what the markets are supposed to do, signal. And Volcker led him one way, and of course Bernanke led him the other way. And I just question, is Powell captured by the Bernanke doctrine, or does he really want to be a Volcker? I don't think he can, because to me, Volcker couldn't be Volcker, as I say, because the amount of debt that Volcker would have to deal with in creating the policies that he had, I think that we would have seen, I mean, we lived through and I'm old enough to know that because I lived through two of the recession, but we would have lived through a 1930s type of economic downturn had Volcker had the overhang of that massive amount of debt.
Your thoughts on that, Dr. Farber? Yeah.
Well, my view is that the Fed has become a money printing institution. And once you embark on money printing, to go back on it and stop it is very difficult. It's possible, but it's painful. And we live in a society where everybody's a victim and nobody has any tolerance for pain. If someone has to tighten his belt, that would be something terrible in a society that is used to socialism. So they keep on printing money, they'll keep on expanding government programs, and as a result of these two interventions, the economy keeps on contracting in real terms, period. But that's what they want. They love it. And wealthy people support all this because they can make money out of it. And some pathologically sick people who are power hungry, they like the power of intervening into the economy. The free market is gone, doesn't exist anymore. The SEC is an institution to protect wealthy people against the ordinary investor. And Ira talks about the markets are corrupted. No, the people that look after the markets are corrupted. The Fed governors, the Fed employees, the healthcare industry is all corrupted. It's not the markets that are corrupted. The people that look after these markets are corrupted. The politicians are corrupted and liars. We have now a beautiful example in the case of Mr. Santos. But people are so used to the lies of politicians that they accept it. They just so, they say, what's new? Biden is a liar, Trump is a liar, Bush was a liar. They're all liars. It's wonderful.
And in Europe, in Germany, what do you make of the bond market there? Do you also see technology companies there beginning to relocate to places like Brazil and China, much like BASF has recently announced? Do you see that as a trend?
Yes, I mean, there's the environment for business in Europe is poor. And equally, the politicians are also of poor quality, actually of very poor quality. And in my view, the interest rates in Europe were kept artificially low. Far too long, longer than the Fed, to be fair to them. They began to increase interest rates in 2021, but the ECB, it's run by someone who was convicted of corruption. But this is the European system. The worse you are, the better suited you are to be promoted on the upside. That's why we have a Ursula von der Leyen running the EU, and then the EU officials. They, for the last 10 years, they complained about Qatar and FIFA, about their corruption. Well, what turned out to be? That the EU officials were corrupt, were running this corruption ring. I tell you, I as an investor, of course, I look at valuations and at earnings and so forth, but it is also a duty of a, let's say, investment advisor or a fund manager to look at the quality of the governments. And I have to say, on that basis, all stocks should be down 50% from the present level. And Ira is completely right. He says the market is still too expensive. Yes, just to get to a normal valuation comparable to previous occasions, the market should still drop 30%. but it can drop 30% in real terms, inflation adjusted, and go up in nominal terms. You understand? You print money, everything goes up, but not inflation adjusted. In this environment, I tell people the best is to diversify. You need to have some assets in emerging markets outside the jurisdiction of the axis of evil comprising the US, Australia, the UK, Canada, and have the money in jurisdiction in Asia and in Latin America and so forth. And you have in emerging markets actually opportunities that are brilliant. Last year, 2022, at the beginning, I was talking about Turkey. Then some Turkish people told me, well, if everything is so bad, it will never go up. Well, the market was up close to 100% in US dollars in 2022. And this year, maybe Hong Kong will have a big move. And China, I think the sentiment about Hong Kong, I mean, I live there on and off, and I still have an office, although I live in Thailand. But I moved to Hong Kong in 73. I've never been seen sentiment this negative as it is at the present time. Well, in recent days, it's improved because the market has gone up. It's already up 30% from the lows. But this is the type of moves that we will have, this volatility. Maybe like in the 70s, the market moved sideways. But 1 year, this group of stocks shoots up 30%, and then the next year, this one, and the other group drops 50%, and so forth. So you will have to be kind of relatively flexible.
Mm-hmm. And you like also Brazil and Argentina?
Yes, I think Brazil is probably going to be a buying opportunity sometimes in the next 3 months. It's already been weak, but I think people are too negative about the Lula regime. I mean, it's not going to be a great regime, but stocks are relatively low, also in Argentina. And geopolitically, you know, some of my friends who are well informed, they think we're headed into World War III. So this is not my view, but some of my well-educated friends believe that. And in this case, probably to have assets in Latin America is probably going to be desirable.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, but it begs a lot of questions. So in Europe, I know that Dr. Faber and I are absolutely in agreement. What's going on there is, again, why would you buy sovereign debt? And not only are you buying sovereign debt, but we're back into the same stupid game. But Dr. Faber has no problem explaining that because they're just corrupt. So why does sovereign debt under BIS have a zero risk weighting, right? That's all sovereign debt is the same. And I would probably argue that, as Dr. Faber would, that the emerging market is probably a better place because at least they're paying you for the risk that you're taking. You're not getting paid at all. And yes, I know that Christine Lagarde inherited everything from Draghi, but she was brought in not for her financial and economic expertise, but for her political expertise and being able to kind of navigate this. But I thought it was interesting last week that Klaus Knot from the Dutch Central Bank actually said in a statement that more than a third of the members of the ECB at the last meeting were in favor of 75 basis point raise, which I thought was interesting because they don't put out their vote totals. But that tells you about what's going on there. And she's under great stress. But the question becomes, and this was asked by another very good friend of mine, Kevin McCarthy, can Germany make it without China? Is Germany, I mean, they're so heavily involved investment-wise, and they exist with China. Can Germany make it without China, Dr. Faber?
Yes, the question is, you know, can the US make it without China? I'm not so sure. Apple can't make it without China. Even if they produce in India, they need Foxconn to produce it. So anyway, the point is, we can go back to the Stone Ages. That's what the environmentalists want. They don't want Europe to buy Russian oil. They don't want to buy Europe to buy natural gas from Russia. It's a lunacy. It's the best economic conditions are for trade to be between two region or two countries that are completely different. Russia doesn't have consumer goods and technology the way Europe has it. And Russia has the resources which we in Europe don't have. This is the perfect union. And it's been a perfect union for centuries because Russia and Europe culturally are much closer than Europe and the US.
And so as we move around, and so we go from the Eurasian landmass, which, I mean, this has been where history has been locked in for quite a long time. But when you see what's going on, does that, because all of a sudden I look at the world and I see what's going on and I get very bullish Japan, which is not easy to do. But the weak yen, I mean, when the yen went up to 150 yen to the dollar, I thought it was preposterous. You were handing the keys back to Japan, which they were missing. But even with the yen where it is, I read one article after another. Here, I have them in front of me. Last chance to make Japan a semiconductor superpower. Japan corporate pre-tax profits hit record, CapEx up 10%. So things are going on in Japan, and Japan is, and then, you know, from we got, it seems to be the word of the word of 2023 is Zeitenwende, right? Everybody's talking about a historic turning. You know, Olaf Scholz wrote that the world was at a historic turning. Japan is now going to spend a lot of money on defense. And people in the United States think that, well, that means that's good for US because the Japanese are going to buy everything from the US. I don't see that at all. Japan can turn a key tomorrow and ramp up their defense industries and actually start competing with everybody else in the world. So how do you see that?
Well, I'm against the weapon industry anyway, because the more weapons you sell and the more weapons you place around the world, the more likely they will be used by some generals and so forth. So I'm a pacifist in this respect. I'm against any war. And wars, all the wars that have occurred, none of them has ever made any sense. The people who fight in the trenches and so forth, they die, and the people who send them there, they sit in comfortable chairs in bars and restaurants and in their offices and so forth. It's a horrible business, and I oppose it very strongly. And I think that it was a huge mistake of the West not to accept the fact that Ukraine should not be a NATO member, which was agreed right from the start when the war broke in 89, that NATO wouldn't expand towards the East. But it's expanded, and I don't know, they just want to destroy Russia. And they want to destroy Europe.
I'm with you. I'm glad to hear, because I don't own one defense stock. I've never bought one. I'm an Eisenhower. You know what? The military industrial complex. And the beginning of bad budgeting begins with the defense budget, in my estimation. That's the way I feel. So, yeah, you know, but Japan is going to be ramping up its defense spending. When they tell you that, believe it. And it doesn't make the world a better place.
It won't. But, you know, all the countries will ramp it up. And then one day, that's why some of my friends who are intelligent, they say, think World War III will break out. I'm also prepared for it. I think that I'm in a relatively good condition here in Chiang Mai, in the north of Thailand. But of course, this is a sensitive area because in the north, we have China. And in the west, we have Burma. And in the east, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And so how this will play out, I don't know. I'm lucky I'm an old man, so I don't have to see all the disasters that are going to happen. But I'm just reading about the prehistoric times. And there were times when the climate got hot and then it got cold and we had ice ages and so forth. And then there were gigantic volcanic eruptions that destroyed everything, but everything, all lives, because the ground was covered everywhere by a meter of lava and ashes. And so we'll have lots of disasters. This is also documented in the Bible that there were from time to time natural disasters, and it will happen again. The tragedy, I was just looking at a documentary about R.J. Oppenheimer. He's the creator kind of the nuclear bomb and so on. I mean, he created the bomb, but once he had created it, he was very depressed about it because he saw the dangers. And we are the first generation of humans that have it in our power to destroy ourselves entirely. That we had this power before through socialism and so forth, that has destroyed a lot of things. The Bolsheviks in Russia were a disaster, much more cruel than the Germans ever were. that should be noted duly.
And you know what? And with what's going on in Ukraine, when Putin raises the issue of tactical nuclear weapons, people just kind of like brush it off. I don't brush that off. You know, Henry Kissinger did his graduate thesis on foreign policy and tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. These are not to, I listen to people talk about them like, you know, it's the weather forecast. No, once you go down that road, you have let a genie out of this bottle that is very dangerous. So, you know, where are we going to go here? Where are we going to go here? How does this end? I have no idea.
But yeah, we don't know.
We don't know.
One thing is sure, Putin cannot afford to lose the war.
Yeah, that's...
He can afford to have a peace treaty that somewhere, somehow gives him some face, that Russia keeps, say, the Krim island, and which is important strategically for Russia. It's not important strategically for the US or for anyone else, but you know, a negotiated settlement would be the best option because you don't want Ukraine to win the war either.
Will
be a very bad option.
And so at a macro level, Dr. Farber, do you then see like the world dividing perhaps into two, like a bipolar world, the World Economic Forum based countries versus the Belt and Road Forum based countries? And if so, what are the implications, right, to the financial?
Well, I mean, I'd like to answer this question the following way. As you know, the World Cup final FIFA World Cup final was one of the greatest sporting events ever. Much bigger than the Super Bowls and things like this. Are you hearing me still?
Yes.
Okay, because the picture got stuck somewhere on your side. Anyway, it was the biggest sporting event ever and one of the most thrilling football matches. And the whole world, that I can say, the whole world was happy that Argentina won and not the NATO country. And people, when they always say, you know, Biden always says, I strengthen NATO. This is, of course, nonsense. NATO has many different views within NATO. And the Europeans are very split about what to do next and so forth. As soon as people lose money, they become more pragmatic again and less ideological. So I wish the Europeans lose 50% of the money. Some of them have actually. And then they will wake up from their political lethargic attitude. Because I'll give you an example. I'm a member of the committee for the neutrality of Switzerland, okay? I have wealthy friends in Switzerland and people I went to school with, they're affluent because I went to private school. It wasn't my doing, it was my parents that had the money to pay for it and so forth. And I wrote to them that they should sign this petition. We have the referendum in Switzerland where you collect signatures and then it comes to a vote in front of the people. 98% don't respond. They're not interested. I tell them this is a very important thing for Switzerland to be neutral. Actually, Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, suggested that it would be best for Britain to be neutral because it's not a world power anymore. India has just overtaken the UK as the fifth largest economy in the world, which is natural. India has 1.3 billion people. They produce 400,000 mathematical and science graduates every year. How many are produced in England? They produce Grab drivers, and they have migrants that come without any education, but with criminal backgrounds. The whole of Europe will become a battlefield. Just as Chicago, and Baltimore, and San Francisco, and New York. Good. Welcome to the socialists. But as I said, I would diversify. I would have more money in emerging economies. If you look at charts, long-term charts, what has gone down since 2010 against the US market are emerging markets. They fulfill everything of nearing the end of a bear market. The bear market for emerging markets started around 2015. They're down more than 50%, more than 5 years. And the sentiment was very negative until just recently. But you touched on Japan. I have a friend, he's very bullish on Japanese banks. But I tell him I prefer banks in Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand. I think they're much better value.
I was going to ask you, you preempted me. I was going to ask you that question because I happen to be, I've been in it, I've been buying Tokyo Mitsubishi for 8 years, and for 8 years it's done nothing except pay me like a bond. It pays a 4.5% dividend. Okay, and that's what, now at the end of this year, and of course, once Kuroda made that decision that he made, and the markets reacted accordingly, we saw some movement. I mean, the Tokyo Mitsubishi, they had a pretty nice move, and they actually wound up for the year I like to be exact. So they wound up around, 14, 15% on the year, not counting the dividends. But it looks like it wants to move. So I was going to ask you that. Are there any Japanese banks that you would look at and say, well, they're well positioned, especially for around Asia?
I don't think they're a very significant factor around Asia. I mean, if you want the participation in Asia, I think DBS of Singapore would be a better play. Maybank in Malaysia and Bangkok Bank. Bangkok Bank is very powerful in Indochina. It's also Chinese. I mean, not Chinese from the mainland. These are Thai Chinese, but they have old established connections. I used to do business with them. And it's a very closely knitted network of overseas Chinese throughout Asia. Yeah. Because as you know, in Asia, 80% of the businesses outside the government are owned by Chinese groups. Not from they came from the mainland 100, 200 years ago, or 50 years ago, and they started their businesses. So you have all kinds from each provinces, groups of people, and they trust each other. They don't, it's like Jewish communities, they trust each other. They have their own laws, they have their own customs and so forth. And they are also related through marriages and so on. So this is a very powerful group. And it's not expensive. The Thai banks are relatively cheap, in my opinion.
Oh, good. I'm glad we had this discussion. Because, I listen to people who talk about the coming recession, and the knee-jerk is always to go and buy bonds. But to me, that's an old way of looking at the world. I have no way to know what I'm buying a bond at today. To buy a 10-year U.S. Treasury at 3.7%, that even if the Fed pauses because the economy starts to slow, inflation, let's say, and I'm going to use their numbers, come down to 4 to 3.5%. It's still, to me, a ridiculous investment. And if things go that bad that we're going to go there, I'll just be short the equity markets in the developed world. I don't have to buy a 3.7%. 10-year yield bond. To me, it's just preposterous, especially, and I last question that I would put to you, the growth, and this is an issue I've discussed with my good friend again, Kevin McCarthy, we've talked about it. When the interest on the U.S. deficit, the federal deficit, exceeds the defense budget, the politics in the United States are going to get very ugly. Because they'll be fighting for every discretionary dollar.
Well, they fight. What happens is in a uniparty such as we have in Washington, the Democrats spend on this and the Republicans or some Republicans say, okay, we let you do that. But in turn, you let us spend on that. And so the whole process is actually a disaster in the long run. This whole fiscal deficit, not only for the US, also in Japan and in Europe, in the long run, it's going to be a disaster, as you say, because the interest expenditures on the debt will go up dramatically. In Japan, if interest on the debt doubles, which is very easy to do from the low level of interest they have. The 10 years is still at 0.45%. I mean, you have to be crazy to buy that bond.
But
I agree with you that that's why I'm telling people, whatever you do, you should prepare yourself not to make money. You should think of how do I lose the least? And the threat is the government, because the government, if they could lock up people, they can come and say, look, you have gold, emergency measures, we need to collect your gold. You have gold shares, they need to be nationalized. And so forth and so on. Wealth taxes, and you have a house. Oh, rent control, a complete disaster for any real estate market. I tell you, the biggest threat to any living person are governments and the bureaucracy. They do not represent individuals. They represent themselves. It's a power, an evil power, period. It's all been written down in books for the last 100 years. Nothing new. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, I will need to leave because I need to do some work from time to time
to support this is,
my modest this is lifestyle.
This is work.
Okay, that's been great discussion. Thank you so much, Dr. Faber, for the insightful discussion and your views. And Ira as well. Yeah.
Richard, thank you. And Dr. Faber, really, you know what? For all the years that I've read you, for all the years I bought a Barron so I could read you in the round table for the first weeks of January, my world comes alive, and I thank you for that. It's just a pleasure. Just a pleasure.
Well, we don't know, but the damage central banks have done to the world by keeping interest rates artificially low for far too long. And for the central bank, inflation is when the price of tomatoes goes up and of consumer goods. But inflation is also when the price of assets go up, because the affordability for people who don't own these assets diminishes, and it creates social problems and increases wealth inequality. So I'd say the policies of the central banks in the last 10, well, I'd say actually last 30 years have been increasingly more and more devastating for the health of a growing economy.
Yep, fully agree. And just to reiterate Dr. Mark Faber's website, gloomboomdoom.com, and Ira's blog, iragharris.com. Thank you so much,
Dr. Thank Faber. You.
And happy new year to all of you.
Thank you. Happy new year, Dr. Faber. Yeah. Hope to do this again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Happy new year. And I hope that everybody will not lose too much money, because 2022, I can tell you, a lot of people, young people, lost everything they had. Everything. In meme stocks, in cryptos, in scams, in fraudulent activities, and. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.